The next day, he led me to Mr. Boritsky's forge, where Nathan had made the gems sparkle. At the moment, they lay on a chamois cloth. Reaching into his pocket, he withdrew a linen handkerchief, spread it out, and counted 15 diamonds, absent the one the cops took. Before knotting the hanky, he added several thousand dollars for the loss of the 16th stone. "This goes to Masseria," he said, handing me the priceless bundle. 15 of them, and cash." "What if they want more dough?" I said, suddenly terrified. AR smiled, and in the European manner pinched both my cheeks. "Leave that to me." To pacify me further, he added, "What do you need to keep you content while you're here on the lam and doing business with me?" AR had grands. That much was clear. So I decided to ask for the moon. I told him I wanted my mother to join me in a house of our own. But AR, who never missed a chance to double his bucks, replied by pointing out that the nearby village of Carmel, 12 miles away, lacked places for visitors to stay overnight. He would therefore buy Mom and me a farm there, and we could rent rooms and give him a cut. "In that neck of the woods," he said, "you can get a farm and the fields and the woods and the streams that come with it for less than a grand. What do you say?" "We have an apartment in the city. Mom may not want to give up." "I'll pay for that, too, until you decide which place you like better." That's how Mom and I landed in Carmel. Named for the mountain in Israel, where the prophets Elijah and Elisha walked among the vineyard slopes, Carmel was originally called Beaver Dam, until the land developers, idealists, philanthropists, and immigrants arrived. Talk about small. The town had only one street, Irving Avenue, with a few rutted roads branching off. Why folks had gone to the trouble of naming it was beyond me. The townspeople talked about going downtown or uptown, a stretch of no more than a few hundred yards. The street had two buildings of note, the Shul, Beth Hillel, built in 1908, and Columbia Hall, which served as a library, lecture hall, and dance pavilion. It was here that the anarchists and socialists, fervently preaching atheism and a redistribution of wealth, tried to forge the locals into a union of workers. The town, divided between factories and farms, was slowly giving way to the former, and the factory workers were the more radical and well-read of the two. The farmers, who grew mostly rye, string beans, strawberries, peppers, vegetables, buckwheat, and corn, also raised cattle and poultry. It seemed a great many of them were putting their future in eggs. Carmel was a close-knit community, not without its enjoyments. Dances, amateur concerts, operettas. I particularly liked the hayrides to Morris River and Parvin Lake. It was on a ride to the river that I met Ben Cohen, the first boy to give me a tumble. But I'll come to that part of the story soon enough. Our farm stood across the street from the shul and next door to the butcher's shop, which served only kosher. The house stood about 50 yards from the road and was approached by a gravel drive that ran back to the barn. Since most of the lawn was actually weed, parking space presented no problem. A screened porch bounded the house on two sides. The front door was entered by crossing the porch. Inside, one faced a steep row of steps leading upstairs to a U-shaped hallway. At the base of the U was the bathroom, on each side, two bedrooms. The first floor was divided in half. On the south side was a large dining room with a pot-bellied stove and an attached bunkhouse that served as a kitchen and pantry. On the north side were the two downstairs bedrooms, separated by a bathroom with a toilet, sink, and a large cast-iron basin for bathing. Just outside the kitchen, in a cleared area of the yard, a badly warped table supported a scrubbing board, a used cake of Baraxo, and a brush. A few feet away stood a pump with a wooden tub to catch the overflow water and provide a place to wash and soak clothes. Three chicken coops and a barn were abutted by woods. A path led into the trees, but it was not until later that I discovered the stream and the arrowheads and the beavers and the damn poison ivy. Whatever the price for the house, it could not have been much because A.R. never squawked. He just took out his wad, unfolded C-notes, as he might have paper napkins, and scribbled something in the black book he always carried. A couple days later, I met Mom at the train station in Bridgeton. She'd left New York's West 23rd Street depot at 8:45 and arrived less than 2 hours later at 10:18, right on time. She was carrying not suitcases, but an enormous reed basket, the kind you see the babushkas unloading when they get off the boats at Ellis Island. When we embraced, Mom started to cry, saying she feared she'd lost me. When Mr. Houdini called, I could hardly breathe. My Hanny arrested. Then when you rang and said you had run from the officers, I sat down and said Kaddish. It's all a mistake, Mom. I'll explain to you later. She looked at me skeptically. Mothers, you know, love their children even when they're thieves. I embraced her again. Honest, Mom, you needn't worry. A.R., who was to return to the city the same day, waited for us in the parking lot. I took one handle of the basket and Mom the other as we schlepped it out to the car. A.R. courteously asked Mom how she'd managed the basket all by herself. She replied that the taxi driver's a nice Italian boy had carried it right to the train. He must have hit you up good, A.R. responded, putting the basket in the trunk of the car. Mom seemed puzzled. Why would such a well-mannered young boy want to hit me? A.R. looked at Mom as if she were some oddity. I mean, Mrs. Fine, he must have asked for some hefty tip. He refused to take any more than the fare. You kidding? He must be new to this country. When we arrived at the farm, A.R. carried the basket into the house and made some crack about not wanting a tip. He told Mom to furnish the place as she liked, whatever you need, beds, pots, silverware, mattresses, whatever, just charge it to me. I have an account at Brotman's in Vineland. He'll deliver. Promising to get word to Harry that I was safe and would not need a lawyer, he said he would also inform Miseria and Zucanier to collect the stones from me at the rooming house. The sign we posted at the foot of the path said Fine Guest House. It was my idea. I thought it was cute, but at 16 we think that every dumb thing is so cutesy. Mom telephoned her relatives to relay our address, and I called Mr. Courtney to tell him how to find me should he ever be in this part of the woods. Taking my cue from all the pulp novels I'd read, I had poured the diamonds and cash into an old sock and stashed it all in the bottom of a flower pot. Over the next several days, I can't tell you how many times I checked to make sure they were there. The moment I got up, and the last thing I did before bed was to check on the loot. The same day that Brotman delivered a household of goods, our first boarder showed up, an Italian house painter, Jimmy. He disclosed neither his age, 30, nor his surname, and spoke with an accent, though his comprehension of English was good. His passion, gin rummy, drew other players. At a penny a pint, he cleaned out more than one of the gamblers who gathered each night on our porch. I never could tell whether his name resulted from his desire to repeat it for the listener's sake, may your name's a Jimmy, or from some belief in its magical powers, because whenever he was losing at cards, he would keep repeating, a Jimmy, a Jimmy. And more often than not, the invocation really worked. His luck would soon start to turn. A second boarder, a man in his 40s, moved in a few days later. Mr. Joseph Schneiderman, a tailor, had grown up in the Moldavian section of Romania, and as a teenager had followed his family first to Argentina and then to Philadelphia. He'd come to southern New Jersey in search of needlework, which someone had told him was plentiful. He arrived carrying a suitcase and a black bag that looked just like the kind doctors carry when making house calls. It had needles of every imaginable shape and spools of thread. Whereas Jimmy's hands were always spotted with paint, Mr. Schneiderman's were never without a thimble, which he constantly fingered as one might an amulet or a charm. Both Mr. Schneiderman and Jimmy worked downtown, our house was uptown, at the corner of Irving Avenue, just before it splits off toward Vineland and Millville. This corner had two factories across the street from each other. One made men's clothing, and the other produced nurses' uniforms dyed blue, and periodically dumped the used dye in the river. The last two boarders moved in the day after Mr. Schneiderman. A married couple, they arrived in Vineland by train, but unable to find adequate lodging, they hired a farmer with a wagon and horse to bring them and their luggage to the new rooming house in Carmel. Her name was Miner, which she said was short for Minoshker, the name her father gave her, the Tsar of all Russia. Her friends, she observed, called her the Princess. She was about 25, with long blonde hair and a bosom that bounced when she walked. Her husband was considerably older, maybe 45 or 50. He was over 6 feet and strikingly debonair in tweedy jackets, slacks, white shirts, and silk ties. A pipe with rich-smelling tobacco was rarely far from his mouth, and he walked as if someone had welded a rod from his derriere to his neck. His name, Leroy Godard, sounded like one of those fancy hyphenated English monikers the dukes always use. And in fact, he said that his family had descended from the Dukes of Stratford, and that he had held, his word, the chair of surgery at Harvard College. Initially, I wondered if that meant he was a waiter, but he called himself a scholar and used the title professor. His starchiness led me to call him the prof. Mom and I had adjoining bedrooms upstairs, as did Jimmy and Mr. Schneiderman. The prof and the princess slept in separate rooms downstairs. My bedroom had one great advantage: a metal air vent in the floor that opened on the princess's room. Though not as pretty as Lily, she was no prune face, and she could play the piano like Myra Hess. Mom had bought an upright piano. It was on wheels and could be easily moved. Normally, it stood in the dining room, but each morning the princess rolled the piano into her room and played Schubert and Chopin. The food, every bit of it kosher, was all cooked by Mom. I washed the dishes. She prepared kreplach and kugel, kishker and kasher, and numerous other Jewish foods, including fresh-baked challah, every third day. Mr. Schneiderman loved it, but Jimmy wanted ravioli and pasta. Finally, Mom convinced him that kreplach was the Yiddish version of Italian ravioli. The prof and the princess persuaded themselves that in a previous life, Mom had been chef to Hillel. Her food, therefore, befitted their stature and rank. The truth was that although Mom could make a pretty good Jewish dish, she knew little else. Upon her arrival, the princess had announced that she was a medium who could summon the spirits and asked for permission to use our dining room a few nights a week to hold seances. Mom, without pausing, agreed. The princess said that in Russia, Rasputin had passed on to her his magical powers. How that came about, she never explained. The prof, smoother than cough drops, did most of the talking, while she stood by looking innocent of any deceits. Harry's warnings ran through my head. At the first seance, which the prof and the princess had advertised with handbills, admission 5 cents, 8 men and 2 women showed up, not counting Mr. Schneiderman and Jimmy, who were admitted for free. The princess had hung dark shades over the windows, covered the dining room table with a green felt cloth, which made it look like a pool table, and put a red candle in front of her chair. She didn't appear until everyone was seated, the lights were turned off, and the prof had given us a lecture that sounded to me like phonus balonus. I would remind you, he said, that spiritualism is not a new invention. It goes back at least as far as the Old Testament, where Saul asked the witch of Endor to bring forth the spirit of Samuel, and she did. In our modern age, believers in the spirit age include Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who has lectured widely on the subject, Sir Oliver Lodge, the famed British physicist, William James, the eminent psychologist, and, of course, Thomas Edison. The prof asked that we each give our names and say something about our employment. When it came to me, I really laid on the schmaltz, claiming to have come to South Jersey in search of my Uncle Sam, a man of high ideals kidnapped by capitalists. No sooner had we finished our spiels than a few bars of violin music were heard. I knew that the prof and the princess owned a vitroler, as did Mr. Schneiderman, but I couldn't tell for sure if their phonograph was the source. Jimmy asked, "Dove la musica?" The prof must have understood, because he replied, "Through certain peculiarly endowed individuals known as psychics or mediums, the human spirit can communicate with us." Obviously, the spirits feel the princess's presence. They are being playful, bringing us music. She will be here in a minute. Please do not speak to her or touch her. She will be wearing slippers, silk stockings, and a diaphanous dressing gown, revealing nature's loveliness beneath, so you can see in the candlelight that she's concealing nothing on her person. As she enters the room, I will turn off the lights. She will quickly go into a trance, at which time her spirit guide, Walter Stinson, will make his presence known. Walter is the princess's brother. He was killed in a train accident in St. Petersburg, but his personality has survived physical death. A rustling preceded the princess's entrance. Suddenly she was standing there, wearing a shmata so thin that I could see stretch marks next to her navel. She sat down, put her head back, and before you could spell Mississippi, passed into a trance. At least that's what it looked like to me. A moment later, another voice spoke through her mouth. I knew from what Harriet told me that the sitters were expected to believe that some dead person was using the medium's body to speak. A good trance medium, therefore, had to be able to use different voices. Walter's voice was rough and raspy, and he frequently swore. Immediately, Mr. Schneiderman asked, "Can you read my mind, Walter?"
"Yes, but you wouldn't want me to spill the beans about that."
I had to laugh. Since when did Russian nobility talk about beans? One of the sitters asked, "When you relax in the spirit world, do you surround yourself with pretty girls?"
"I'm only 28. Whenever pretty girls are around, I'm in no mood to relax."
Someone else wanted to know, "Do you never age? Are you always 28?
"Yes, that's why it's good to die young."
"What's it like up there?"
"Just like down below, but free of heart and hunger."
"You dance?"
"The Charleston."
"And do the hoochie-coochie?"
"Every night."
"But if you're just a spirit, just air without a body, how do you..."
"Do the hoochie-coochie with spirit."
Everyone laughed, including me.
"No, really, Walter, I mean," said the prof before being cut off, "bump and grind, press and sweat, stay and roost, take your choice."
One of the two women sitters, Mom had remained in her room, remarked that she found this kind of talk far too risque. But that didn't stop the off-color patter. It continued until Mr. Malcolm Bird, a reporter for the Vineland Evening Journal, asked, "If you have supernatural powers, why not make yourself visible?"
"I am visible."
"How can you say that?"
"You hear me."
"But what do you look like?"
"Just listen and see."
Mr. Bird scribbled some notes. I'm not interested in philosophy. The newspaper I represent is looking for proof that mediums can actually cross over and speak to the dead.
I believe there's a Mr. Irwin among you.
Mr. Irwin, a railway worker, lurched forward against the table and said, I'm here.
You had a son lost in the Great War. Isn't that why you came to the seance?
A pop-eyed Mr. Irwin replied, How did you know?
He's here with me.
Dear Jonathan, cried Mr. Irwin.
I'm safe now, Dad. I've crossed over.
Ecstatically, Mr. Irwin put out his arms and started pawing the air. Tears welled up in my eyes to see this wrinkled railroad man in overalls trying to touch his dead son.
It's my boy, he said in amazement, repeating this line as he turned to each of the sitters.
I think of you and Mother every day, Dad.
By now, Mr. Irwin had entered a realm of the mind where no one could follow. Utterly transported, he shouted,
It's a miracle! The princess has done it! She's reached my dead son! The spirit lives!
The seance broke up when a disembodied hand appeared, eliciting gasps and one or two shrieks, and the prof announced that his wife was coming out of her trance. Sure enough, she opened her eyes, looked around, and silently walked to her room. Mr. Bird begged for an interview, but the prof wouldn't allow it.
Once the seance has ended, he said, my wife needs time to recover. If you wish to see her, mornings are best.
The other sitters were equally enthusiastic, except perhaps for the women, who said they were unaccustomed to such language. Jimmy kept asking in his broken English if spirits played cards. Mr. Irwin beamed happily, saying that death had now been defanged, and Mr. Schneiderman, shaking his head, twice remarked, I'm skeptical, but I don't know how to debunk it. The next morning, Mr. Malcolm Bird showed up in a downpour and asked for the princess. He was wearing a rumpled raincoat and hat and carried an umbrella. The prof asked him to wait until she'd finished her toilet, a statement that I took to mean nature called. It wasn't until I heard the phrase several times that I realized it meant only that she was still getting dressed. When she asked to see Mr. Bird alone in her room, I excused myself and made for my vent. Frankly, I thought she'd be dressed like a princess, but instead she greeted Mr. Bird wearing a flimsy slip and nothing else underneath. Do you believe in love at first sight? She said provocatively. I suppose so, Mr. Bird stammered.
The moment I saw you, I felt peculiar vibrations.
Looking like a fawning puppy, he gulped, Really?
You remind me of the disheveled professors one sees among the Cambridge bookstalls.
I'm new on the job, he panted, just a fledgling reporter.
You must be my age, she said. You have a lovely smile, and I like your hair, particularly the way it's unruly.
She used the word unruly as if it had some other secret meaning. Even I could tell she was vamping him. By the time she got through, he'd be singing her praises in print, even if he believed she was bogus.
Your eyes bring to mind children's songs and lemonade. Tell me about yourself. I so want to hear.
He stumbled all over himself, relating how he'd once taught arithmetic and how he loved writing and books, which had led him to find a job as a journalist.
What I like about you, Malcolm, you will let me call you Malcolm, I hope. What I like is that you're open to new possibilities, another life.
By now, she was shaping the putty that once had been Malcolm into the servant she wanted. What a sap! He fell hook, line, and sinker for her mush, and immediately launched his own flood of compliments. You could have gagged on the sugar. Given their expressions of mutual admiration, I was hardly surprised to see Malcolm drive up every day. In the meantime, he'd written an article for the Vineland Evening Journal that claimed the princess was the genuine thing and that she could actually speak to the dead. As a result, the requests for seats at the next seance ran into hundreds. The princess and prof would have takers for months. I was glad, because then Mom needn't worry about their paying the rent. But though I enjoyed both her company and her seances, I knew she was peddling snake oil. How she pulled off her tricks, I was yet to discover. But this much I knew. She was one darn good actress. By the end of the week, Malcolm was worshipping at the hem of the princess's dress. She'd even renamed him, as I learned from my eavesdropping.
"I've had a change of mind," she enthused. "I won't call you Malcolm. It sounds far too formal. I'll call you Birdie. Unless, of course, you don't want me to."
"No, no, whatever you like," he gurgled. "I'd be flattered."
"You're such a goose, or should I say bird, blushing about the name."
And here she became brazenly seductive.
"Now, if I had called you dear or honey or lover, you'd have cause to be flustered."
"Lover? But we just met. I mean, a few days ago."
"I feel as if I've known you for ages. Don't you think we ought to be bridging the gap?"
Malcolm seemed dazed. He tried to reply, but his words kept misfiring. Finally, the princess came to his aid, suggesting that as long as he had a car, they were free to drive out of town.